Yesterday, in our discussion of the study of the Hebrew language, we were speaking about, number one, the sources of the knowledge of Hebrew. And we noticed how great a part tradition has played in our knowledge. We had a tremendous start in it by that. We have a tremendous help from it, particularly when a word occurs only a very few times in the Old Testament. But tradition can be mistaken. Errors can come in as people pass on the understanding of a language. And then we notice second cognates and what tremendous attention was paid to them for a while. But how now it is realized by most linguistic scholars that cognates can be tremendously valuable in giving suggestions for investigation, but that they do not actually prove anything about a language, because languages can develop in different directions. And then we looked at C, usage, which is the way to determine what a language means. But you have to have a fairly large number of instances in order for usage to be really determined. And since the Old Testament is all the ancient Hebrew we have, except for a few short inscriptions, since that's the case, we are very grateful for the help we get from tradition and from cognate on those places where usage does not give us a sufficient number of instances to make a complete judgment. But wherever you have a fairly sizable number of cases, usage certainly can determine. And where you have only a few cases, often usage will disprove a widely held theory based solely on tradition. The possibility of knowledge of Hebrew has been greatly extended by a new source of knowledge within recent years. So I'll call that number two. The discoveries of Ugarithmics. The discoveries of Ugarithmics. U-G-A-R-I-T-I-C. In 1928, at that time the French held what is now Lebanon and Syria under the mandate from the League of Nations. And there was a Department of Antiquities. There was one in Palestine under the British. There was one in, that was all called Syria then, under the French. And a very fine French archaeologist was making a trip to visit some ancient places. The Director of Antiquities said to him, as you go up the coast of the Mediterranean there, he said, there is a place called Ras Shamra, a little promontory there, where the natives have for some time been sending in word that there were antiquities. Now, he said, the natives are always finding a couple of old potsherds and thinking it's the greatest discovery ever made, and most of what they say we don't pay much attention to, but they keep on stressing that this is a real possible source of valuable material. Oh, as you go by, stop and take a look at it and see if there's anything worth further investigating. Well, Dr. Schaeffer, S-C-H-A-E-F-S-E-R, Dr. Schaeffer, S-C-H-A-E-F-S-E-R, stopped at the place, began investigating, and for the next 20 years, he spent a great part of his time excavating at this spot and studying what he found. Because he found there the remains, the buried remains of an ancient city, and eventually they decided from the remains and from certain statements they found that this was an ancient city called Ugarit, U-G-A-R-I-T, a city which had been destroyed before the Israelites became of any special importance in Palestine. Perhaps before they came in, even. Certainly before the end of the time of judge. Yes, the person. U-G-A-R-I-T. Now, these discoveries there, for the next 15 years or so after their discovery, were always referred to as Ras Shamra. The Ras Shamra Antiquities. That's capital R-A-S, capital S-H-A-M-R-A. For 15 years or more, that was the name always applied to these discoveries. because that's the modern name of the spot or of the area where they were found. But then when it was discovered that the ancient name of the town had been Ugarit, that name naturally displaced the other. So today you rarely hear about Rosh Hashanah. Once in a while you'll see a reference to Rosh Hashanah. But you will often now see references to Ugarit. Ugarit being this ancient name of a town, not a tremendously important town, but a town of some size, and a town which had a very strategic location, because being right on the Mediterranean, at a good place for commerce to come in and go out, it had connection with other areas in the Mediterranean, and also commercial materials came to it overland from Mesopotamia, and so it had connections with the various countries of the Middle East, at the Near East, as we call the ancient, that in ancient times, at that period. And so you have a combination of materials from many different areas meeting here in Rosh Hashanah. But the most interesting thing found in Rosh Hashanah, which soon came to light, was some tablets written in a type of writing that had never before been seen. Now, on examining this writing, it was evident that it was quite similar to cuneiform. That is to say, it was written mostly on clay tablets. And it was wedge-shaped characters. That is, characters made as if you had what they call a stylus, which is somewhat like the end of a screwdriver. But as you press it into the clay, one end goes a little deeper than the other end, so it makes a wider part at one end of the impression that's made by pushing this stylus into the clay. And then combinations of these marks made with this stylus, like if you were to take a piece of clay and take a screwdriver and press it in here and here and here and make little marks in it that way. Combinations of those make up the different types of cuneiform writing. But this writing differed from the cuneiform writing of Babylon and the other countries, in that there were less than 30 individual characters, which were repeated over and over. Well, that's quite different from the 300 characters of Babylonia. And so the result was that it was a very good guess that it was an alphabetic writing. But as to what the characters meant, what the reading could mean, nobody knew for some little time. And then there occurred what someone has said was the most fortunate or the most important of all the results of World War I. That is to say that in World War I, French experts were busy trying to decipher German codes, and German experts were busy trying to decipher French codes, and the result was that the men got trained who deciphered the Ugaritic writing. At any rate, there was a French scholar, Professor Dorn, in Jerusalem, who was studying this writing and figured out a good guess as to what a number of the signs might mean. Others he didn't seem to make much progress in. A German scholar in Hamburg, Germany, wrote an article in a German paper in which he told how he had figured out about 3/4 of the characters. The other 4 he didn't seem to make much progress. This paper from Germany came to the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem. Professor William F. Albright, later professor in Johns Hopkins University, was then director of the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, a great student of French and German investigations. He read this German paper, and immediately he went over to the French school, where Professor Dorn was, and showed it to him. And when Dorn read it, he found that the man in Hamburg had figured out the signs he hadn't been able to figure out. And he had already figured out the ones the German cryptographer hadn't yet figured out. So putting them the two of them together, there was a very good interpretation of what these different signs meant. And from that, they went on to read these tablets, and they found that while many of them were business documents of one sort and another, and lists of various kinds, things that would be perhaps not very meaningful unless you knew more of the situation at the time, there were a very sizable number of them which consisted of poetry.
And the poetry gave us the myths of the ancient Canaanites. Now, these tablets of the poetry are many of them quite broken. The very few of the signs carry any indication of vowels. Practically all of them, most of them, only indicate the consonant. But many of the words are quite similar to Hebrew. And the result is, with a great deal of repetition in these poems, with occasional slight change differences in them, and with many words that are easily recognizable from their similarity to Hebrew, before long there was a large amount of Canaanite religious literature available from about 1100 or 1200 B.C. And as far as study of Hebrew language is concerned, this is the discovery which has made more excitement in the scholarly world than anything else in the last 100 years, as far as understanding of Hebrew is concerned. There was great discussion among scholars, some of whom said Ugaritic is a language similar to Aramaic, a distinct and different language, while there were others who said, no, this is a dialect of Hebrew. Well, the difference may be largely semantic. It may be that the difference between it and Hebrew is about like the difference between the way we talk and the way people talk in certain parts of England, where I couldn't understand a word they said until I listened 2 or 3 days and got at least a bit more into the general situation. It may be only that much difference and still to be called the same language. Or it may be a difference, say, like Portuguese and Spanish, where a good many words are different, pronunciation is different in many ways, and yet they say that a Portuguese speaker can understand most things in Spanish fairly easily, although they are different languages. So whether to call it a different language or the same language is a matter of terminology. The simplest way is just to call it Ugaritic. But this Ugaritic has been, these texts, one very commendable thing about them is that they have been printed very soon after their discovery. They have printed the texts, some of the ancient texts that have been found in other places. A scholar who's discovered them has kept them to study them, wanting to give the last word on them before they're published, and it's been 20 or 30 years before the rest of the world knew much about them. But in this case, very soon they began publishing copies of the texts, and people could study these texts and try to make advances in the understanding of the language. There are certain features that are very different from Hebrew. There are others very similar to Hebrew, and of course, not having vowels written, hardly at all, often, where there might be a great difference, you wouldn't notice it. While the consonants being the same, you see a great similarity. I was talking with a man this summer in an institution where in their beginning Hebrew class, they take a month to study Ugaritic. And he said, I tell the students, you know some Hebrew, there's a great deal of this Ugaritic material you can read without any difficulty. And there's a lot more of it, he says, that nobody can read. And I think that that is something that people forget. There are parts of it that if you know Hebrew fairly well, you read quite easily. There are other parts that just nobody knows what it means. Because many of the tablets are broken, and you have to fill in the broken places by guess if possible. And we don't have the vowels at all. It's much of it is poetry where you're not quite sure what it means. It implies things without saying it. And yet that's to some extent made up by the fact that there's a tremendous amount of repetition in it. But it gives us myths about ancient Canaanite gods and their fights and their squabbles and their weddings and their relations to one another and that sort of thing. And sometimes you'll find a word that occurs only 2 or 3 times in the Old Testament. You may find 6 or 8 times in this Ugaritic material in a context that will give you pretty good insight as to what it means. Now, there are scholars who say this is tremendously overrated, its relation to Hebrew, that actually it was spoken several hundred years before most of the Bible was written in a different area, and people with entirely different beliefs, and probably if we had the vowels, we'd see how very different it was, and that it's very silly to think that you can revise your knowledge of Hebrew from it. On the other hand, there are other scholars who go to the opposite extreme and feel that any time you find a word in Ugaritic with a certain meaning and context, you can revise your whole Old Testament in order to change the meaning to fit that. And so we have at present people writing from both extremes regarding it. Some say that our whole understanding of the Psalms and the prophetic books is going to be revived with the knowledge that we get of the Hebrew language from the Ugarit. I think those claims are greatly overdrawn. But there certainly is need of Christian scholars who study this material and are able to say from first-hand knowledge when somebody says, look at this word in the Psalms or in the prophets here, it must mean this of what is in Ugaritic. Who can answer, well, it occurs in two contexts in Ugaritic that are very vague. Nobody's sure what it means there. That's no basis for building it here. But who can say in another case, yes, that's right. There are 30 cases where this occurs in Ugaritic. The context is very clear, and the meaning fits perfectly. Here is probably a very excellent suggestion as to the meaning of this word here. Instead of just taking a wholesale rejection or a wholesale acceptance, it is not so difficult to work into the material because as new material has appeared, new editions have been published of a book surveying the whole material and presenting in it most of the text in transliteration, some of them in text, and a glossary, and it's very handy to get at the material as it has been published. It's been published by the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, most of the work for it being done by a Jewish professor in Brandeis University here in Massachusetts. Unfortunately, the copies of the book have many errors in them, many copying errors, and therefore you can't trust the book quite as much as you'd like. Now, I have sat in a committee making a new translation of the Old Testament and found one member of the committee who was ready to change everything in line with Ugaritic. He has a tendency, whenever this Jewish professor in his glossary says this word means so-and-so, to say that proves what it should mean in Hebrew. Although sometimes it represents a guess of this Jewish professor with little foundation. Sometimes it represents a very good estimate based on a fair amount of evidence. And sometimes it represents a very certain interpretation, Ugaritic, based on a lot of evidence. But unless you examine the evidence, it's very foolish just to take his glossary and say this is what it's meant. So this is an area from which great promises are being made for the improvement of our knowledge of Hebrew. I think the promises are greatly overdrawn, and yet there is certainly the possibility of a very considerable addition to our knowledge of Hebrew from Ugaritic material. A professor in the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, a man who was brought up, I believe, in Montana, either Montana or Dakota, I forget which, but who is now a professor there, has published a commentary on the Psalm, in which he, just about every third verse in the Psalm, he changes in line with Ugaritic. And Professor Albright says that if even one third of Dahoud's suggestion proves right, it will be a most tremendous addition to our knowledge of the Psalm. Well, if one-tenth of them prove right, it will be of great interest. But the unfortunate thing is that many people will take all of them as right, and thus real confusion comes into our understanding. And so I do not personally think that the study of Ugaritic has yet proceeded to the point where the average Bible student can put much confidence in it. But I do think we should be aware of it as a field from which some very important results may come in the next few years. Yes, Mr. Warner?
Can the
Reading
Bible study emphasize Ugaritic and Revelation in the Old Testament?
I couldn't really say on that. They have been very free in most of their interpretations, and they haven't given much evidence to know what they've based their interpretations on. Sometimes they're purely guesses on their part, and other times they're the reading of some ancient version, but they don't give you much evidence. You can't tell. The RSV, I don't think, used it at all, hardly. But the RSV did put footnotes which, in most cases, give you a clue as to where they got their idea. But the NAB doesn't have much of that kind, unfortunately. I had a little correspondence about the NAB that I might put up on the bulletin board one of these days. You might be interested to see what was said in relation to it. But this commentary of Dahoud's many people are paying tremendous attention to. And Professor Albright at Johns Hopkins had a series of seminars in which he would have students study the relation of different books to the Euclid, different Old Testament books. And they published their theses, and some of these men are now professors in different universities. And it's having an influence. But you cannot just discard it completely, and it's very foolish to accept it wholesale. It needs very careful, close study before we know just how much dependence can be put on its results. Yes, Mr. Stoltz? Well, there's much argument about that. It is quite similar to Hebrew. It may be as similar to Hebrew as Cockney English is to, say, Southern America. It's quite a little different, and yet the same language. It may be that similar, or it may be as different as Spanish as from Portuguese. So whether to call it another Semitic language or a dialect of Canaanite, nobody can prove, especially if we don't have any vowels. Well, so much then for the discoveries of Ugaritic, which may be of great importance in relation to our knowledge of Hebrew eventually, but have not yet proceeded to the point where we're justified in putting a great deal of dependence on the results. Yes, Mr. Warren?
How do you spell Dahoud?
Dahoud, the man who wrote this commentary on Psalms, D-A-H-O-O-D. D-A-H-O-O-D. His parents came from Lebanon to either Massachusetts or North Dakota, I forget which. He was born there, now he's gone to Rome and teaches in the Pontifical Biblical Institute. Now, number three, methods of progress in the understanding of Hebrew. This is perhaps for a seminary class the most practical part of our investigation of Hebrew. How can the individual make progress in understanding Hebrew better, or perhaps in discovering things about it not previously known? Well, under that, small a is the study of form. The study of form. I always put great stress on learning the main types of Hebrew verb form so that one can recognize them immediately, because otherwise you don't have any solid basis for interpretation. Now, this is a matter on which, if you know the four main types, you can fairly easily recognize, I'd say, 3/4, at least maybe 9/10 of the verbs in the Old Testament. But there are certain ones that are unusual, certain ones that are peculiar, and a thorough further study in recognition of unusual forms will naturally be of importance and of help in understanding the Old Testament. And for this purpose, the grammar by Gesenius, which we call Gesenius Couch, Couch, K-A-U-T-Z-S-C-H, Gesenius Couch, is a grammar which was published in German and translated into English quite a few years ago now, but it's the most comprehensive grammar that we have yet of Hebrew. And for study of verbs, it gives you just about all the peculiar and unusual cases and gives you an interpretation of them. I would say the worst thing a person can do in studying Hebrew is to use what they call the analytical Hebrew dictionary, because that is merely a crutch. You take a form and it'll tell you what the form is, but you can fairly easily learn the principles of recognizing most of the forms. And the rare forms, it's far better to get an authoritative statement on the possibilities than it is to use a crutch like this. But it will tend to make one not get the regular form well in mind. And so I strongly recommend against using an analytical Hebrew dictionary. But with Gesenius Couch, you can find a discussion explanation of most of the unusual forms, and if you get the principles in mind, it is a real help in making progress in the understanding, of course, of Hebrew. Now, more important than that for making your progress in really understanding the meaning of the Old Testament is small b, the study of syntax. The study of syntax. Now, by syntax, we mean what is the meaning of these forms. What is the meaning of the combinations of words that are used? How are words put together to give certain meanings? And of course, this is very important in any language, and it differs from one language to another. You get a few main principles of syntax in beginning Hebrew, such as the use of the construct, so different from anything in our Indo-European languages, and a little bit of the difference of the two tenses, perfect and imperfect. When you only have two tenses, and you have about a dozen in Greek or in English, it is, in this regard, has much less variety, but to learn really what the difference between these is quite an extensive study, and this can be very valuable. Further study in syntax, unfortunately, a great deal has been taken for granted in the past. You know, I mentioned to you Dr. Speiser's advance in the understanding of the Hispa'iyya. There are, I am convinced, many advances that can be made simply by studying forms in context, studying the way they're used in the Old Testament, the way different combinations of words are used, and the way different forms are used. I'm convinced that much further light can be thrown on the true meaning of Hebrew than has yet been done. Among the Jews, there has been a tremendous amount of study through the last 2,000 years of the Hebrew, but unfortunately, a very great part of that study has consisted of just noticing combinations of words with no principle involved. Like I was in a class in the University of Pennsylvania, where there was a Jewish student from New York who made the remark, he said, "I don't think you people are paying enough attention to the advances the rabbis have made in this understanding of Old Testament passages." Professor Montgomery said, "Well, what do you have in mind, for instance?" Well, he said, the book of Judges begins with the words, "And it came to pass in the days of," and goes on, "in the days of the judges, and there was a famine." Then he pointed to another place where it began, "It came to pass in the days of," and this is two Hebrew words, "Wayahidimei." He said, both cases where it has the words, "It came to pass in the days of," there's trouble for Israel here. Well, you can see, whenever it says it came to pass in the days of, to say that means trouble for Israel ahead is a sort of making conclusions by accidental combinations of words without any real principle involved. And while Jewish students have made many very valuable discoveries in connection with the study of Hebrew, there's an awful lot that has been done by some of them of that type of thing that is completely a waste of time. And that is unfortunate. But as to the real study of what the meaning is of forms, when I mentioned in Berlin in 1927 the possibility of writing a thesis on Hebrew grammar, they said, "Oh, that's all been done. That's all complete long ago." Well, it is. There's a great deal that is yet to be done in it. But of course, we have the main principles passed on traditionally and worked on by modern scholars and in fairly good condition. But there is much progress to be made in the careful study of Hebrew syntax. Professor Driver, one of the three authors of Brown, Driver, and Briggs, wrote a book on Hebrew tenses, which went through a large number of editions and had a great influence in improving our understanding of the Hebrew tenses. I think at this point it might be worthwhile to make you familiar a little bit about the name Driver, because there's two of them who may be confused. There's S.R. Driver and G.R. Driver. S.R. Driver was one of the three editors of the Brown, Driver, and Briggs Dictionary. He was a very great scholar, and his work shows tremendous acumen and covered a great breadth of knowledge and very well expressed. Unfortunately, as a young man, he went to Germany and studied under the higher critics and became thoroughly imbued with the higher criticism of the Pentateuch and of other books. And while always claiming to be a devout follower of Christ, his attitude toward the Old Testament carried the higher criticism pretty far, and his book had perhaps as much influence as any individual in spreading the higher criticism to the English-speaking world. The book went through many editions between 1891 and 1925 and has, within the last 2 years, been reprinted and published in a paperback edition. It is as well-written and clearly expressed an introduction to what some would call the moderate criticism, though it's pretty radical. But there's other that's far more radical, so it's often called the moderate criticism but it's as well written and clearly expressed as any book on the subject. Very concise, a great deal of material put together very well. Many of his views were very unfortunate and very harmful, but he was a real scholar. Now his son is G.R. Dryden, recently knighted. This letter I speak of refers to him as Sir Godfrey. He was the head in the latter years of the Old Testament section of the preparation of the New English Bible. He has done a great deal of his study in Arabic, and my impression is his study of Hebrew has been quite superficial. 20 years ago, I was told that he was getting out a new edition of the Brown, Driver, and Briggs Dictionary, and I protested very strongly to the Oxford University Press about it. And they have not yet gotten it out, and I don't know whether my protest helped in delaying it or not, but I fear that it will come out soon, because after all, the Brown, Driver, and Briggs Dictionary is now about 60 years old, I guess. And so it's rather natural to want a new one that brings the recent evidence up to date. But my impression is that, as far as Hebrew is concerned, that Godfrey Driver is not at all in the same level as his father. And I fear that it's going to be decreased in value when he brings it out. So I hope you will all be sure to get a Brown, Driver, and Briggs Dictionary while you can get one in the present edition. I have no reason to think the new edition they'll get out one of these days will be anywhere near as good. Mr. Cavallari?
Yes, you mentioned that S.R. Driver, the father.
Yeah.
His book. Now, did he write a book?
Oh, he wrote a number of books, but I referred to two of them. I referred to his book on Hebrew tenses. Hebrew tenses, which went through a number of editions. And then I also referred to his book called Introduction to the Old Testament. Now his book, Introduction to the Literature of the Old Testament, is usually referred to by the letters L-O-T, Literature of the Old Testament. That book we will use extensively next semester in the course of the Introduction to the Pentateuch. And if you feel like buying a paperback copy of it, I think you would find it useful in connection with that course. It was republished about 4 or 5 years ago. The previous edition was 1925. Driver then, S.R. Driver, was a really high-class caliber scholar, unfortunately off in the wrong direction on many of his views. But what he's written is mostly clearly expressed and represents a great amount of knowledge and is always worth reading whether his results are right or wrong. And I regret to say I cannot say the same thing about his son at all. Time magazine wrote me quoting what they claim were letters from the son. And I wrote back and said, I hope there's some mistake that he really didn't say these things because they were so utterly unscholarly that I just can't imagine he could have. And yet they gave them as a quotation from him. Mr. Varner? In Oxford. They're both in Oxford. Well, the study of syntax, and there is much further study needed. And for one who is specializing in Semitic study or Old Testament study, there's a possibility of making some real advance. I had a student who wrote a thesis for me, a master thesis on the Hithael, and that was not too big for a master's thesis because the number of Hithaels is far less than of any other of the stems of the Hebrew. I'd like to see the same sort of a job done on the Niphel, but there are probably 5 times as many Niphels in the Old Testament as in the Hithael, so it would be a much harder job. It really should have the several people working together. But to people specializing in it, Hebrew syntax can be a field for great advance, and for the ordinary student of the Bible, advancing your knowledge of syntax, of Hebrew syntax, can be of very real value. And there are cases where the King James Version, for some reason, has departed from just simple, ordinary understanding of Hebrew forms. There are a few cases where that's very important, like in the book of Joel, where it says they called on the people to pray, and the people expressed their repentance and prayed to God, and God sent deliverance from the plague of the locusts. And the King James translated, then will the people pray, and then will God hear their prayer and send deliverance, when the tense is very clearly represented as past rather than future. And I believe that was the result of a theological idea on the part of the translators of the King James Version, but it has resulted in great confusion in the minds of most interpreters of the book of Joel. Now, there aren't many cases like that in the King James Version. On the whole, it's an excellent translation. But there are a few cases where perfectly obvious points of Hebrew syntax have been overlooked. And with even what you get in 1 year of Hebrew, there's few places you should be able fairly easily to recognize. Now, number three is the area in which everyone can find great help in the study of the Hebrew language, and many, without a great deal of background, may even make real progress. And this is a very important area. This is, see, word study. Word study. What is the meaning of a word? What does it really mean? If you study any other language, you soon begin to realize that words are not points. Words are like circles. Words are areas of meaning. And it is hardly ever will two words in two languages exactly coincide. One expresses a certain area of meaning, another expresses an overlapping area of meaning. And to get an exact idea of what words really mean in any language is a difficult thing. Words change their meaning constantly. I mentioned the case of terrific yesterday. I wonder how many of you realize that the word nice never occurs in the King James Version. The word nice is one of our common words today, or at least it was when I was a boy. I imagine it still is. But the word nice 500 years ago meant ignorant. It's derived from the Latin nescio, not to know. Nice meant ignorant. And then nice came to mean making very fine distinctions, fussing about little tiny points. And so a man who was a very nice man might be a very disagreeable man, one who's always fussing about little points. We use it still in that sense sometimes today as we speak of that's a very nice distinction, meaning it's a very fine, well, fine again, means very exact and precise, and yet we use it in the sense of pleasant or good, as we use both. But the word nice has come just within the last century to be one of our commonest words for pleasant. And even a century ago, or at least a century and a half ago, that meaning was very rare for the word. Well, to learn to understand the exact meaning of words is adds greatly to your knowledge in any field. And when it comes to the Hebrew, of course, we have our dictionary. Now, the most useless thing for anybody who wants to go very far is a little pocket dictionary in any language. I realized that when I was first in Germany. My first day in Germany, I didn't know a great deal of German yet. I went to a place to eat, and I finished lunch, and I was in a hurry to get somewhere, and they didn't come with the bill. And I wanted to pay the bill and get out, and nobody came. At that time in Germany, it was considered very impolite to give anybody a bill unless he asked for it. And so I wanted to get out, and I didn't know how to ask for it. And I had a little pocket dictionary, so I looked up bill. And it gave two German words. It said, Rechnung, Schnabel. Well, I didn't know whether to ask for the Rechnung or ask for the Schnabel. So fortunately, there was another section that was German-English. And there I looked up Schnabel, and it said the bill or beak of a bird. So I said, bring me the Schnabel, which to him would mean the beak of a bird. He wouldn't know what I was driving at all. And a little dictionary that just gives you a rough approximation of the meaning of a word. I found people my first week there were constantly using the word seemly. And I'd never heard the word before. I didn't know what it meant. I looked up in the German to English part and it said seemly, tolerable. Well, what does tolerable mean? Something you can endure? Something you can stand? Well, I very soon found in actual use that it means more tolerably, fairly, somewhat. Are you feeling comfortable? Oh, it seems like fairly comfortable, see? Is it too hot? Oh, it seems like kind of. That's what it means. But just the little dictionary says tolerable, and that doesn't give much idea. So So a little dictionary, there are many little dictionaries of Hebrew available, and most of them aren't worth the paper they're written on, because it doesn't give you enough idea of what the word really means. Now, the best dictionary of Hebrew is Brown, Driver, and Briggs Hebrew Dictionary. That is the best dictionary of Hebrew. It is published by the Oxford Press, and it is written by three modernists, and so it is very foolish to trust their ideas. But it has done a more thorough job of giving you all the context than any other dictionary that has been published. And so though it's now nearly 70 years old, or nearly 60 years old, I guess, the Brown, Driver, and Briggs Dictionary, which is called an edition of Yesenius' dictionary, this dictionary, on any word, will give you a fuller account of its usage than any other dictionary I know of. And when you look in Brown, Driver, and Briggs, and you find that they give a meaning for a word, and they give 100 cases where it occurs, you can pretty well trust it. When it gives one or two, you'd better examine, because the modernist presuppositions may have affected their interpretation. But it is the best dictionary we have by far. Now, there are later dictionaries, which are of value as having later theories or as referring to later discussion. But they're all briefer than Brown, Driver, and Briggs, and therefore you're more dependent on the writers of the dictionary for a conclusion instead of simply for giving you the facts on which you can base your own conclusion. Mr. Huff?
Could you give an example of how we should be careful about certain interpretations?
In the Brown, Driver, and Briggs dictionary? Yes, well, there was a... professor in Fuller Seminary when the RSV came out, who wrote a little booklet in which on the matter of the word virgin in Isaiah. And he said that if fundamentalists are going to have any credit or recognition as scholars, they should recognize that the Hebrew word Alma means a young woman, whether married or not, because that's what's said in all three of our good Hebrew dictionaries. Well, the three dictionaries that he referred to, two of them were editions of Gesenius' dictionary. And Gesenius himself was quite a thoroughgoing unbeliever. And these dictionaries say the word Alma means a young woman, whether married or not. That's what they say. But as a matter of fact, the word Alma occurs only 9 times in the Old Testament. And there is no case of it where there's any evidence whatever that it refers to a married woman or to an impure woman either. And when the Septuagint, 200 B.C., translated it virgin, we have good evidence for that. Well, I was interested in this professor's statement. We must take what the dictionaries say. Well, three of the ones he referred to, of the three, two were editions of Gesenius. One of them was an edition of Gesenius brought out by Professor Tregellis in England. And I happened to have it in my library, and I opened it up, and I found the statement, Alma, a young woman, whether... a marriageable age, whether married or not, and then there was a square bracket, and then Professor Tregellis said, this definition by Gesenius shows his thoroughly rationalistic attitude and is not based on fact. But this professor had simply given that as one of the dictionaries which say this, which we must trust if we are to have any recognition as scholars. Professor Robert Dick Wilson examined all the 9 cases rather thoroughly, wrote an article about it about 50 years ago. Actually, there is absolutely no evidence. In this letter I referred to a few minutes ago, I had the Time magazine, which said in their article about the NEB, it translates as young woman because the word is clearly used in the Old Testament to people who are not virgins. I wrote them. I said, there is no such case. I said, this is an utterly erroneous statement. I didn't hear from them for 6 weeks. And then they quoted G.R. Driver as saying that in a certain verse, in Judges, the word is used for a concubine who is clearly not a virgin. And I looked up the passage, and the word Alma doesn't refer anywhere in the context. The ordinary Hebrew word concubine occurs there. It's hard for me to believe G.R. Driver would have said such a thing unless he thought he was just like for people who didn't know any Hebrew anyway. You could say anything. And yet I can't quite think a man with his standing would do a thing like that. Maybe he turned the letter over to some assistant and said, please answer this letter from Time magazine. I don't know. But it just shows how You cannot just take a modernist statement about something. You need to look at the facts and see what they are. Brown, Diver, and Briggs has a more complete presentation of the facts than any other Hebrew dictionary. So it makes it easy for you to look at the facts and make your own judgment. And in many cases, like with prepositions, where they'll give you, where there are hundreds of uses, they will arrange them in categories according to context and so on, and it's very, very valuable and very useful. But you have to use it with care. You cannot just say, Brown, Diver, and Briggs says it, therefore it's so. If they only give one or two instances, well, their say-so is worth nothing. Look at the instances and look at other evidence. Well, Brown, Diver, and Briggs, then, is our best dictionary, though there were two German scholars, one of them in Switzerland, Köhler Baumgartner, who got out a new dictionary about 15 years ago, and the dictionary came out with every word they gave the meaning in German discussion, and then followed it by it in English. And you can see how that doubled the length of it. And the whole thing's only about two-thirds as big as Brown, Diver, and Briggs, so you can see how much less real value it gets. And the English is translated literally from the German, and sometimes very poorly translated. I understand they're getting out a new edition and leaving out the English part of it, which will be an improvement, I'm sure. Now, it has an advantage for one who wants to do thorough study because it has references to discussions in scientific magazines and so on of particular works. So it has an advantage in having references to later discussions. But it doesn't have as full a presentation of the occurrences in the Hebrew Bible. And therefore, is not as immediately useful as is Brown, Diver, and Briggs for this purpose. Before word study, it is always useful to see what Brown, Diver, and Briggs may say about a cognate, which sometimes is important, sometimes not at all important. It's useful to see how they arrange it and see how much evidence they give. But for careful study, the very best help is a concordance. And when you get a concordance, and for the ordinary person, even knowing no Hebrew, a great deal can be learned about Hebrew words by using Young's concordance. Because you can look in the back of Young's under, and they even transliterate the words. It's not a very good scientific transliteration, but it's good enough that you can find any particular word there and see how it's translated in the King James Version. And if you find that Asa is translated, say, 300 times as do, and 200 as make, and 20 as show, then you can look up the cases, look under show in the dictionary, in the concordance, and see all the cases of Asa meaning show they put all together. And as I mentioned yesterday, when they all mean to show mercy, it indicates to you clearly that it does not mean show in our modern sense at all. And so with Young's, it's a little bit of bother looking in the back for for the person who doesn't know Hebrew. For instance, they take the word watch in the New Testament. Person who doesn't know Greek could look up watch in Young's concordance, and there they would find that where it says watch, for you know not the day nor the hour when the Son of Man cometh, there are two Greek words used in these dozen or more cases where that's said. One of them is agrupneo and the other is gregoreo. You look up those and then you look them up in the back and you see how they're translated. And you find that both of these words, in addition to being translated watch, are translated be wide awake, be vigilant. And you look at the context and you find that anyone even not knowing Greek can easily see this from Young's concordance, that the words agrupneo and gregoreo do not mean run to the window and look and see if you see him coming. They mean be wide awake, be vigilant, be on the job. As the gospel says, blessed is he whom his master finds giving his servants their meat in due season. Watch, for you know not when the Son of Man comes. It doesn't mean keep looking to see if it's getting nearer all the time, because we're told that in such an hour as you think not the Son of Man comes. But it means be active in the Lord's service, so that when he comes, he'll find you actively serving him. Be wide awake. Do not let the cares of this world and the feeling the Lord delays his coming lead you to think, oh, well, I'll enjoy myself for the next 2 months, and then I'll get busy in the Lord's work and I'll be active in it when he comes. You don't know, he might come today, he might come tomorrow. Well, now, there are other words that mean to see something happen and to watch in that sense. And there are other words that mean to watch, to look for if you see it coming down the street. But watch in the sense, it's an Old English sense, not our present sense. Paul speaks of himself in watchings off, by which he meant spending the whole night in the Lord's church, wide awake. It means be wide awake, be vigilant. Well, now you can figure that out without knowing any Greek. Now you might make some mistakes if you don't know Greek, but you won't make a great many. And you can get a great deal of knowledge of the meaning of Greek and Hebrew words just from Young's Concordance. And of course, if you know some Greek, if you know some Hebrew, you have a help to get far more good out of it. But the concordance, Young's Concordance, Strong mixes all the words together. It's much quicker than Young's to find a passage. But for study, it's all mixed together and it just has numbers to indicate. And I don't think it's worth a fourth of what Young did for study. But then there's the Englishman's Hebrew Concordance, and there's also the Englishman's Greek Concordance. And those are very useful for the person who knows some Hebrew and Greek, but who's not a great master in these fields. Because in that, they arrange it under the Hebrew word, or under the Greek word, and then they give all the cases with the English context. And you can run your eye right down that in a hurry and see the three-fourths of them exactly fit for a certain meaning and some don't. And then you can take those few and examine them and then look up the context where you want to and where you think it wise. And that way you can make as much progress in an hour as you would in 20 hours without the use of that tool. Well, I see we'll have to continue there tomorrow. Yeah.